us. Also, special thanks to you, our guests, for staying with us on this issue of Spotlight. It's good night for now and bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic never tolerates Israel's presence near its borders, noting the regime will have no place in the future of the region. Algeria recalls its ambassador to France following a recent decision by Paris to slash the number of visas for Algerian nationals. Mexican police clash with protesters holding a rally in the capital, Mexico City, to mark the 53rd anniversary of massacre of students. Welcome to the program. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran will never tolerate the presence of Israeli elements near its borders. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran is worried that Israel and terrorist elements threaten the security of neighboring Azerbaijan. He noted that Iran has been expressing concern over the matter since last year's conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Amir Abdullahian stressed that Israel will not have any place in the region's future. He said Tehran and Baku are working to address issues related to their bilateral ties through diplomatic channels. Elsewhere in his remarks, Iran's top diplomat slammed Bahrain for normalizing ties with Israel, adding that the move will not improve the situation for the Al Khalifa regime. The Iranian Army's Air Defense Force has unveiled a new surveillance radar along with other defense equipment. Our very own Yusuf Jalali now reports.
This Iranian radar system just detected and destroyed an intruding ballistic missile. Not a real missile, but a virtual one. Dubbed Shams, the radar system can create simulated electronic warfare scenarios to train fresh military personnel. The system was unveiled together with other defense equipment, all built by the Iranian Army's Air Defense Force.
The fully indigenous Shams system is a long-range radar simulator and allows us to design and execute a range of war scenarios. This way we can enhance the preparedness of our staff members against potential missile attacks and other aerial threats.
Hormuz was another radar system that was put into service on Saturday. It's a medium-range tactical radar capable of detecting and tracking air targets at high, medium, and low altitudes. Iran's Air Defense Force says the new equipment will significantly increase the country's air defense capability.
The major feature of Hormuz's radar system is that it can calculate the speed of the target while accurately calculating the distance and sending the data to the fire control systems. I should say that all of the equipment on Whale today and earlier were designed and produced using domestic know-how. We no longer need to import any such equipment from other countries.
Iran has for 4 decades been under U.S.-led arms embargoes, which prevent the country from purchasing any foreign-made arms. This has over the years prompted the Islamic Republic to try to develop its own weapons to ensure its security. Every year, the country unveils a range of domestically built defense equipment, from UAVs to missiles, as a show of its military might against the backdrop of U.S. sanctions.
The Islamic Republic views U.S. sanctions as a tailwind that has pushed the country toward self-reliance. While these latest military equipment can be counted as a case in point, army officials say this is just the tip of the iceberg, as Iran has indigenized over 80% of its defense arsenal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's human rights attaché in Geneva has urged the international community to take immediate, tough, and effective measures to end Israeli crimes in Palestine. Mohammad Sadati Nejad blamed Israel for its crimes, including genocide, ethnic cleansing, systematic torture, and arbitrary detention against Palestinians over the past 7 decades. He stressed that bringing the Israeli regime to justice for its crimes against Palestinians must become one of the international community's demands. He noted that Palestinian children are accused of throwing stone at Israeli soldiers, while hundreds of them are held in a dire situation in Israeli jails. An investigative report has linked a British Royal Air Force base to the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. London-based journalist Barnaby Pace has come up with the report that concludes the secretive men with Hill intelligence site in Yorkshire, was probably used to assist in the deadly 2020 drone strike in Iraq. Pace says both U.S. and U.K. personnel stationed at the base operated, quote, beyond public scrutiny and accountability. Campaigners are now putting pressure on British ministers to explain whether data from the site was used to assassinate Qasem Soleimani. The Iranian general was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps when he was targeted outside Baghdad airport, if you recall. The widow of the dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has called on the United States to hold Riyadh accountable for the brutal murder of her husband at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul 3 years ago.
MBS took Jamal from me and the entire world. Will you hold him accountable? Or will you reward his murderers? President Biden and Vice President Harris, when will you step up and fulfill your promises? When will you translate your words into action? Or will your administration continue business and as usual despite promising change?
Khashoggi's widow further described him as someone who championed the rights of the Saudi people. She made the comments at a candlelit vigil held in Washington, D.C. to remember the slain journalist. In the ceremony, Hatice Cengiz also unveiled a large-scale portrait composed of Khashoggi's columns in the Washington Post.
Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi-born, U.S.-based journalist and outspoken critic of the Saudi government, was assassinated on October the 2nd, 2018. His death shocked the world because he was killed in one of the most brutal and unusual ways possible. On the day of his assassination, Khashoggi walked into the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul. Khashoggi never came out of the building.
Where is Jamal Khashoggi?
What do we know about really what happened to Jamal Khashoggi?
Turkish police insist that they know what they're looking for.
Well, the Saudis haven't been telling the truth right from the start.
Horrifying accounts have emerged of how the 59-year-old was murdered, who was responsible, and what happened to his remains. After more than 2 weeks of denials, Saudi Arabia eventually admitted that he had been killed in the consulate. The Saudis insisted that he was murdered in a rogue operation. But the international community demanded answers. Turkish investigators said video and audio recordings prove that he was tortured, killed, and dismembered. Further findings revealed that the gruesome murder was ordered by the highest level of the Saudi leadership. Later on, the United Nations confirmed it as well.
I have insisted that the killing of Mr. Khashoggi is a state killing. It is not a killing by rogue officials.
The Saudi government said 11 people had been indicted in connection with Khashoggi's killing. But a report by the CIA determined that the killing was ordered by no other than Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudis later claimed that what happened to Khashoggi was the result of a failed interrogation. Ample evidence provided by different intelligence agencies have proved otherwise. Khashoggi was once close to the Al Saud royal family and served as an advisor to the regime. But later, he fell sharply out of favor with Riyadh. In September 2017, he left the kingdom and went into self-imposed exile in the US. In his Washington Post columns, Khashoggi was highly critical of the Saudi crown prince. The case of Khashoggi has come to be known as one of the most outrageous examples of how a government targets its critics. It has also exposed the fact that Saudi Arabia's Western allies are absolutely unwilling to risk their ties and trade deals by taking a firm stance against gross human rights violations committed by Riyadh.
Algeria has recalled its ambassador to France following a recent decision by Paris to slash the number of visas for Algerian nationals. The Algerian presidency said its ambassador had been recalled for consultations. The Arab country has called Paris's decision unilateral and summoned the French ambassador to Algiers to protest it. On Tuesday, France said it will significantly reduce the number of visas granted to citizens of Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. France cited those countries' refusal to take back their nationals who had been denied visas by Paris. Morocco has called France's decision unjustified. Tunisia has not commented yet. Clashes between police and protesters have erupted in the streets, of the Mexican capital on the anniversary marking the 1968 massacre of students in the city. The police, in riot gear, fired tear gas to disperse thousands of demonstrators who descended on Mexico City chanting slogans and raising their fists. The protesters fought back, hurling rocks and projectiles. The Tlatelolco, if I'm not mistaken, massacre occurred when the Mexican armed forces opened fire on thousands of university and high school students demanding democratic reforms in the then authoritarian Mexico. Activists say up to 300 people were killed during the crackdown. Russia has reported more than 25,200 new infections from COVID in the past 24 hours. The figure is the highest daily case tally in Russia since July. The country's total COVID infections are now above 7.4 million. On Saturday, Russia also logged 886 new deaths that bring its total fatalities to over 208,000. COVID has surged in Russia in the past few months, partly because of the Delta variant. The strain has given a surge to the disease in the U.S. as well. On Friday, total fatalities there surpassed the grim threshold of 700,000. That's equivalent to the population of the U.S. capital, Washington, D.C. A Reuters tally shows that global deaths from COVID have passed the 5 million mark. Pakistan says it has started talks with the militant groups which launched retaliatory attacks against U.S. invasion of neighboring Afghanistan over the past two decades. Correspondent Javed Rana is in Islamabad.
Pakistan has lost tens of thousands of its citizens and security personnel since late 2001 when Islamabad joined so-called U.S. war on terror. Pakistan provided the U.S. with its military bases to carry out attacks on Afghanistan and allow the NATO supply line to pass through Pakistan to the neighboring country. But it all backfired with the retaliatory attacks and massive public resentment against the U.S. and successive governments for supporting American imperialistic agenda across the region. After a recent humiliating exit of U.S. from Afghanistan and the return of Taliban government in Kabul, Islamabad has changed its pro-U.S. policy. Now Pakistan has decided to bring an end to two decades-long violence through negotiation with the different groups working under the umbrella of Pakistani brand of Taliban movement and other groups engaging in insurgency in southwestern Balochistan province.
In fact, I think some of the Pakistani Taliban groups actually want to talk to the to our government, you know, for some peace, for some reconciliation. And we are in talks with some of the groups. I do not believe in military solutions. I'm anti-military solutions. So I always believe that, you know, as a politician, political dialogue is the way ahead.
Before the change of guards in Kabul, Pakistan blamed India to have been using different militant groups from Afghan soil to fan insurgency in its southwestern and northwestern regions bordering with Afghanistan.
The Ashraf Ghani government and other hostile governments in Kabul were providing them conducive conditions to attack Pakistan. But now that the Taliban are there and Taliban have guaranteed or have assured Pakistan that the Afghan land will not be used will not be allowed to be used against Pakistan.
Many militant groups have repeatedly attacked in Pakistan on Beijing's economic and geostrategic interests linked with its global project known as Belt and Road Initiative. The mega project starts from Chinese province Xinjiang and passes through nearly 3,000 kilometer long road network of Pakistan before sailing through Arabian Sea to reach onwards rest of Asia, Africa, and parts of Europe. Both Washington and New Delhi have publicly opposed the China's mega project, which has challenged the economic hegemony of the U.S. Now Islamabad wants to win over the terrorist groups through a reconciliation process in an effort to wean them away from the foreign powers, using them to disrupt over $50 billion U.S. dollar investment of China in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight.
There are so many untold stories about Haiti. We need to begin with the United States' refusal to recognize Haiti after its independence in 1804. Most people do not know the story of the U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934, or that of the resistance movement led mainly by the peasant group known as Les Cacas, as well as by students and intellectuals, which forced the U.S. to end the occupation. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Cecily, a Sicilian writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Media Have Distorted Narratives on Haiti Since 1804. It's still happening. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. There are so many untold stories about Haiti. We need to begin with the United States' refusal to recognize Haiti after its independence in 1804. For over 60 years, while the U.S. was still a slave-owning nation, Haiti as the world's first free black republic was ignored and punished. That early refusal to recognize Haiti's independence was a failure to acknowledge the humanity of Haitians, and a failure to acknowledge the humanity of enslaved people within the United States as well. Responsible reporting about Haiti needs to start here, with that lack of humanity. Most people do not know the story of the U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934, or that of the resistance movement, led mainly by the peasant group known as Les Cacus, as well as by students and intellectuals, which forced the United States to end the occupation. But the damage to Haiti's constitution was already done. Haiti has been referred to as the Republic of NGOs because of the large number of non-governmental organizations or NGOs working in Haiti. The majority of these NGOs contribute directly and indirectly to weakening the Haitian state by focusing on the interests of the country and organizations that they represent and not working with grassroots organizations to have a real impact. The deep corruption of the Haitian government is connected with the 2% of Haitians with foreign passports who own Haiti and are constantly capitalizing on the ongoing disasters, both human-made and natural, so they can maintain their privilege. These 2% who work behind the scenes in what we usually refer to as a politique du doubleur, or supported by the superpowers, U.S., Canada, France, the United Nations, etc. For instance, during elections, the elite usually work with these superpowers to ensure that their chosen candidates become president so that they can better control Haiti. Let us not forget the neoliberal economic policies that contribute to food insecurity and prevent food sovereignty, forcing peasants to leave their lands and move to urban areas in search of a better life, but instead enter a cycle of worse poverty. There is the complicated story of rural livestock in Haiti that were slaughtered and destroyed in 1980s by the U.S. to prevent the spread of African swine fever into the United States. The livestock represented a savings bank for the farmers, but the indigenous livestock were replaced with imported animals that were ill-adapted to the tropical climate. The wholesale death of rural livestock subsequently dismantled the livelihood of countless numbers of farmers. This impacted the Haitian economy so much that there was a direct impact on children's education, since farmers were not able to send their kids to school because they couldn't afford tuition and uniforms. In 2010, former President Bill Clinton apologized for the trade policies that destroyed the livelihood of rice farmers in Haiti while enriching Arkansas farmers. The apologies did not help. People continue to starve and have to look for other alternatives. Some Haitian migrants must take treacherous routes from Brazil and Chile to Mexico. While crossing borders, there are economic advantages for these countries because these migrants have to pay for food and accommodation, and the flights from Port-au-Prince to Chile and Brazil contribute to these countries' economies. There is the old myth stemming from colonization that dictates that black bodies are inferior. Let us be clear and honest. If the Haitians were lighter skinned, would they have been given the same treatment? Probably not. The current treatment of Haitians at the border and the use of whips and horses is inhumane. Do those who think it's acceptable to treat Haitians this way see them differently because of their black bodies? Many Haitians are hard workers. There is currently a labor shortage in the United States. What if we could get past the narratives and the images and think that perhaps, just perhaps, some of these Haitian migrants could possibly be able to contribute to the workforce? What if we could identify skill sets that they may have and provide language and acclimatization training so they can contribute these skills for the greater good? In 10, 20, 25, or 100 years, we wonder what a story we will tell of Haiti. Haiti's ongoing climate crisis started during the period of colonization with the French exploiting its natural resources. It continues today in the forms of deforestation, earthquakes, and hurricanes, both man-made disasters and disasters resulting from capitalism, neoliberalism, inequity, and greed. All these are contributing factors that push people to migrate. Perhaps then, the United States will be open to really seeing the Haitian migrants with dignity, compassion, care, empathy, and humanity. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Communique.
At first, they merely suggested it. Now, they've done it. Hezbollah has successfully imported fuel from Iran into Lebanon. Lebanon has been suffering from a deepening economic crisis for almost 2 years now, with power cuts, food shortages, fuel shortages, and total devaluation of its currency. The whole point behind importing the fuel to try and mitigate this. Now, some argue that the shipment undermines Lebanese sovereignty. Others argue it's a victory for the resistance front, with people waving flags in celebration of the fuel's arrival. So why is this shipment so controversial? Has it helped mitigate Lebanon's economic crisis? And how does it affect the overall geopolitical landscape of the Middle East when Syria, Iran, Hezbollah are all able to successfully bypass U.S. sanctions? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Lebanon has been suffering from a severe economic crisis for almost 2 years now. Many factors have contributed to this, one being the political instability, the lack of a central government. Lebanon has only just recently been able to form a new government. Another is corruption. It's widespread. The so-called Ponzi scheme that has been going on for decades and is central to Lebanon's economy. The global pandemic with COVID-19, not to mention the Beirut port explosion. Both these things have made everything worse for Lebanon. Moreover, the war next door in Syria has also impacted the country severely, and vice versa, given how closely Syria and Lebanon's economies are interlinked. And last but not least, the external pressure on Lebanon from the West to try and exclude Hezbollah from the political process. All these things combined have led to a terrible situation where the Lebanese pound, or lira, has lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. Lebanon's situation is so bad, Bloomberg reports that Lebanon's annual inflation rate is now the highest in the world, surpassing Zimbabwe and Venezuela. The result of this is that three-quarters of Lebanon's population now lives in poverty. Prescription and over-the-counter medicine alike are either unavailable or too expensive. Al Jazeera reports that on average, food items today cost 10 times more than what they did in 2019. The price of milk has increased sevenfold, rice 19-fold, cooking oil is 37 times more expensive. The World Food Program says that food prices have risen by 557% since 2019. Just to buy bread for one family, someone earning minimum wage would have to spend 44%, basically half, of their monthly salary. Lebanon is a country that imports 80% of its food, and right now, the food situation is further imperiled by fuel shortages and power cuts. The government just cannot supply people with enough electricity, so people either have no electricity, or most of the day they have to rely instead on private generators. Things like bakeries, for example, need diesel fuel to keep their generators running so they can stay open. But because there isn't enough fuel, instead they have to close, making bread scarce. The power cuts are so severe, people only have electricity for 4 hours, sometimes 2 hours a day. Not just bakeries, but hospitals and essential services have also warned that they are on the brink of collapse as they lack power and electricity to keep functioning. Ironically, even during parliamentary session, the power also went out, which Hezbollah offered to fix by bringing two generators. One of the guests joining me today from Beirut, his internet and electricity cut out in the middle of the interview as we were talking about these power cuts. The suffering of the people in Lebanon is widespread. Scenes like this are typical in Beirut. People queuing up for bread, people queuing up for fuel, hours at a time to try and get something if they're lucky. In August, the central bank announced that it can no longer afford to subsidize fuel. The problem of liquidity plagues Lebanon still as there is a shortage of foreign currency, especially U.S. dollars. While officially, the Lebanese pound is pegged to the U.S. dollar at a rate of 1,500 liras, the black market rate has done nothing but skyrocket with no end in sight. Currently, the rate hovers at around 15,000 Lebanese pounds to the dollar. Basic necessities are either too expensive for people to afford or simply not there. Joining me is Abbas Bazzi, Lebanese political activist and commentator. He's also a board member of the Al Awra organization. Thank you for coming on the show, Abbas. Could you maybe describe to us the economic situation in Lebanon in practical terms, what the crisis is like for everyday people?
Yeah, it's bad. I mean, it's always been tough. I guess it's gotten worse over the last couple of years since the economy tanked a couple of years ago. But now it seems like it's bottomed out, and things are getting really tough for the average Lebanese citizen. What happened is with the devaluation of the Lebanese lira, for a long time, from like I would say from 1997 forward, it was pegged at 1,500, and that sort of stabilized things for a while. But since the economic collapse of a couple of years ago, it went up to about 7,000, 8,000, and finally went up to about, the lowest was about 18,000, Now it's gone down to about 15,000. And it's tough because most people who work there, especially the ones that work for the government, get paid in lira, and their salary is the same. So if a person was getting paid, say, like a million liras a month, which, you know, prior to the economic collapse, would translate to roughly around $700, they're still getting paid a million liras. And now it's, you know, it's not worth $700 anymore. It's basically trying to live on $100 a month. So, you know, imagine trying to sustain a family on $100 a month. It's tough. And, you know, you couple that with a pandemic, and now you have the fuel shortage. I mean, Lebanon's always had a problem providing electricity for its citizens. Outside of Beirut, most people would get like 8 to 10 hours of electricity per day. Now it's down to about 1 hour. And there's a, you know, shortage of gasoline at the gas stations, but waiting in long lines to purchase. Just like, they can't even fill up their gas tanks. They could probably get like a quarter tank or half a tank. So yeah, things are gotten really, really tough recently.
The government raised the price of fuel. Why did they do that after the first shipment arrived?
They didn't really raise up the price. What happened is they removed the subsidies for fuel, which consequently rose the price up. And the reason for that is because they claimed that they didn't have the funds to subsidize it anymore.
When we talk about a de facto American siege on Lebanon, what does one understand by this term? What role exactly is the United States playing in Lebanese politics?
Yeah, as far as the American siege on Lebanon, yeah, I mean, basically, you know, for the past couple of decades, the U.S. has done everything it can to try to break the resistance of Lebanon, and it has used, I wouldn't even call them allies of the U.S., they're just pawns of the U.S., the politicians in Lebanon that the U.S. props up to try to disarm Hezbollah, which they don't have the political clout or the means to do that. But it's like the U.S. uses them, and they use the U.S. So basically, it came to a situation to where the U.S. had no more cards to play. And now, after Hezbollah broke the siege, now the U.S. is trying to, you know, play the role of, well, we can bring in gasoline from Egypt, fuel from Egypt, and we can bring electricity from Jordan, which the U.S. is basically breaking U.S. laws because, as you know, the Caesar Act on Syria. So now the U.S. is forced to deal with Syria to, you know, try to, you know, save face in Lebanon.
The Lebanese Prime Minister Miqati said that the fuel shipments are a, quote, violation of Lebanese sovereignty. What do you make of that exactly? Why do you think he said that?
Yeah, I heard that. That was funny. It was hilarious, actually. I mean, what sovereignty is he talking about? Since when has Lebanon been a sovereign country? I mean, Lebanon was literally, you know, created through Sykes-Picot, not to have any sort of sovereignty, just to weaken, you know, our people in the region, but to you know, to divide us. And Lebanon has never had any sort of sovereignty. So I'd like to know what. I mean, every political power in Lebanon is basically beholden to some sort of external power. So which sovereignty is he talking about that was violated? I mean, if there are some sovereign powers in Lebanon, let them bring fuel. I mean, we're out of, you know, the country's out of fuel. Bring fuel to Lebanon. Show us your sovereignty. Show us your ability. Bring fuel to the country. So this, I mean, this was an act of desperation by Hezbollah. I mean, it got to a point to where it was a national emergency. So if there's any kind of sovereignty that he's talking about, you know, to bring this sovereignty to the table and, bring fuel to the country.
So, Abbas, just as a last question to follow up, this whole situation in Lebanon, what do you think will finally remedy it? What would you like to see happen for things to get better?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, long term, who knows? I mean, like, all these things that are right now, they're all, you know, short-term band-aids. Long-term, I mean, is that possible anytime soon? I'm not sure. I honestly don't know what the long-term solution is. In my opinion, that's the best way is for all of us to unite under, you know, one central entity. But I don't know if the, you know, the groundwork is there for that anytime soon. I think we need to look inward. You know, we need to stop relying on the West because, you know, we We witness a Lebanon what will happen to you when you rely on the West. We mean nothing to them. We're expendable. They'll watch us, starve. We're totally expendable. So we need to look inward and find our solutions among ourselves.
Abbas Bazzi, great speaking with you. Thanks so much for coming on.
You do a great job. Keep up the great work.
Back in June, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah suggested the idea of importing Iranian fuel into Lebanon. And just by merely bringing this up, Iraq went ahead and doubled its supply of crude oil to Lebanon from 500,000 to 1 million tons a year, likely at the discretion of the United States. Although crude oil does not exactly fix Lebanon's problem, as they are in need of fuel. 2 months later, on August 19th, Nasrallah announced fuel shipments from Iran were secured and confirmed. Immediately, the Americans rushed and scrambled to try and stop them. The American ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shia, called up the Lebanese president, Michel Aoun. She explained that the United States would offer an alternative plan to secure Lebanon's energy needs and that they did not need Iran and Hezbollah. The American ambassador floated this extraordinary plan, which involves taking gas from Egypt, electricity from Jordan, and then sending them through Syria to Lebanon. It's quite funny, honestly. The United States is so desperate to undermine Iran and Hezbollah, it is willing to go to such lengths and undertake this extremely complicated process involving four countries just to give Lebanon power. Well, that's great, right? I mean, where was this plan before? Where was the United States rushing to help Lebanon with this intricate idea? As you remember, Syria is under U.S. sanctions, the Caesar Act. And yet, despite that, the United States is still willing to work with Syria, a country it has been at war with and sanctioning for 10 years. Meanwhile, Iran doesn't need to convert anything. It's just bringing diesel and benzene, already refined and ready to go. Nasrallah announced that there will be four shipments of fuel from Iran to Lebanon. Most of this would be diesel with a little bit of benzene as well. Remember that there is a tanker war in the region. Israel has sabotaged and attacked numerous Iranian ships bringing fuel to Syria. The United States has also pirated oil from Iran, headed to Venezuela, simply stealing it and selling it off. Nasrallah issued a warning, saying that the ships are to be regarded as Lebanese soil the moment they set sail, and that any attack on them would be considered an attack on Lebanese sovereignty. And with that said, two of the four ships have already arrived safely. The first ship docked on September 14th in the Syrian port of Banias. The diesel was offloaded into oil tankers and driven to the Lebanese border. And as part of the axis of resistance, Syria provided these trucks for free. President Assad sent the Syrian army to escort them and had all tariffs and taxes lifted. A convoy of 80 trucks carrying with them 4 million liters of fuel made the journey from Banias, and as they crossed over into Lebanon, scores of people lined the streets in celebration of their arrival, waving Syrian, Iranian, and Lebanese flags and holding up signs saying, "Thank you, Iran. Thank you, Syria." In a more extravagant move, one person was so happy he decided to fire an RPG into the air to celebrate the fuel shipment. As Nasrallah had announced, the first shipment of fuel would be going to hospitals, nursing homes, the Lebanese Red Cross, special needs facilities, the fire department, and other essential services. 1 month's supply of fuel completely free of charge. The rest would be sold to everyone else later at below cost, cheap rates with zero profit. A week after the first shipment had arrived, the second oil tanker docked in Banias on September 23rd at 10 p.m. local time, with the other two ships expected in the coming weeks or months. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now, joining me to discuss this further is Lebanese critic and journalist Pierre Abissab, specialized in the literary, artistic, and cultural life of the Arab world. He has worked for many newspapers, such as Al Hayat and Al Safir, and co-founded numerous others. Currently, he serves as the deputy editor of Al Akhbar, a daily Arabic language newspaper. Pierre Abissab, thanks so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you on. So, Pierre, just to start off, how has this shipment of fuel affected Lebanon politically and economically?
Lebanon's economic situation is not just confined to the last months, during which the U.S. decided to starve the people and slap them with sanctions, like they did with Syria and the Seas Rack. With the encouragement of cartels, controlling the distribution of fuel, or lack thereof, and not to mention the political stooges and pawns who work with the United States and Saudi Arabia in the hope that starving the people will create chaos and turn people's opinion against Hezbollah. But the last months mustn't be understood outside the context of the last 30 years, a system rooted in corruption and embezzlement of public funds. We are talking about a monetary system which is essentially a Ponzi scheme that depends on external support and funding, with a complete lack of any real agriculture or industry. So once the money stopped flowing into Lebanon, everything collapsed and small investors were robbed. Meanwhile, the 1% weren't affected. When Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah gave his address on the day commemorating Ashura, he warned the Israeli enemy to stay away from the ships coming to Lebanon, that they are to be considered Lebanese soil. This posed a huge challenge for the Americans. So in response, the American ambassador called President Owen and said, "All this gas in Egypt, we can help bring it to Lebanon." Even though people have been pushing for this idea for years, and the Americans always stood in the way. Not to mention the Caesar Act sanctions on Syria, which have prohibited anything going through Syrian territory. The U.S. ambassador now says, "We have no problem bringing gas and electricity from Egypt to Jordan, through Syria to Lebanon." So all of a sudden, the Americans and Saudis realize that this pressure they have been putting on Lebanon to try and prevent the formation of a government has backfired. It turns out the situation is benefiting Hezbollah, because Hezbollah are now seen as the ones who are trying to prevent the collapse of the country by bringing in fuel and medicine. So to try and put an end to this, suddenly you have a new government being formed after 13 months of sabotage from Saudi Arabia's pawns and the Americans and the French. All of a sudden, we can bring gas from Egypt through Jordan and Syria. Suddenly, they are fine with it coming through Syria. So you see, the arrival of these fuel shipments from Iran broke the siege and broke the political stalemate in Lebanon. It also helps fight all the profiteers who stole and smuggled goods and raise prices to rip people off.
When we saw the convoy of trucks arriving from Syria to Lebanon, they just seemed to be driving in broad daylight, and you know, no one standing in their way. How is that exactly?
Well, what does that tell you? That's all about the balance of power. And they, the Israelis and Americans, know this. If you look at what they are saying in the Zionist media, the Israelis claim that they are turning a blind eye to the fuel shipments because they pity the Lebanese people. But this is not true. If you look at the balance of power today in the region, with this tanker war going on with Iran in the Arabian Sea, the Israeli enemy has had its ships attacked and blown up on numerous occasions. So in this political climate, no one dares to come near the oil tankers in the sea, nor the trucks driven by Hezbollah. Officially, the fuel is coming from a country under sanctions, meaning Iran, and going to another country under sanctions. But these sanctions are a creation of these white American cowboys. These sanctions aren't legitimate, nor were they approved by the United Nations. Right now, Lebanon is weak and in need. Even people who have disagreements with Hezbollah don't care anymore. Right now, all they're saying is, "We want fuel. Whether it comes from Iran or Mars, it doesn't matter. We want fuel." And Hezbollah answered the call of the Lebanese people, even those who oppose them. The blockade has been lifted, and the current balance of power shows that Hezbollah is able to counter the Israeli enemy and prevent virtually anyone interfering with the shipments coming from Iran through Syria.
And how do you feel about the United States' response to this whole situation?
America and its allies won't do anything. They won't dare touch these shipments, neither by sea nor by land. Right now, the United States, France, and Saudi Arabia plan on facing off with Hezbollah at the ballot box by influencing the elections in Lebanon and undermining the democratic electoral process. When it comes to the issue of fuel shipments, they have lost this battle. Despite all their attempts to sway public opinion, to claim that this fuel was stolen, sent to Syria, and then shipped back. Or when they said that Lebanese cars would not work with Iranian benzene, all sorts of absurd claims. They thought they could play on people's fears, that people who are hungry and desperate might fall for these rumors. But this didn't work. The siege on Lebanon has been lifted. Their plan to anger the public has fallen apart. Trying to turn public opinion against resistance, while people don't have any food or gas and so forth, this failed. So they will try to find another way to demonize the resistance during the upcoming elections. Ironically, the thing that I dislike the most about the Lebanese system is that it's a sectarian system, which I wish we could replace with a secular one. This is the thing that's ultimately going to stop America's attempts to undermine our political process.
Thank you so much for coming on the program. It's a pleasure speaking with you. Naturally, not everyone is happy about the arrival of this fuel. There are some critics who say that Hezbollah is undermining the state. But where is the state? There has been no central government in Lebanon for years, and people have no faith in the politicians. Also, what's wrong exactly with giving some hospitals and nursing homes free fuel? I mean, it's certainly not a long-term solution, but it is bringing help to those most in need, free of charge, no strings attached. And yet critics want to reduce it to a PR stunt? Who would risk four oil tankers and all this trouble, so many things possibly going wrong, just for a PR stunt? It's really funny watching the Western politicians and media speak in their usual colonial arrogance, fuming because independent, sovereign countries won't bend the knee to their illegal sanctions. The headlines read that Hezbollah has brought in fuel in defiance of U.S. sanctions. How dare they? The Washington Post said that Hezbollah is flexing its muscle, you know, as if they just imported nuclear weapons. Now, Senator Jim Risch, a Republican from Idaho, he serves as the ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In response to the arrival of Iranian fuel to Lebanon, he said that, quote, Lebanon's received U.S.-sanctioned Iranian fuel trucked in by Hezbollah through Syria is a disappointing sign for the future of Lebanon's accountability and democracy. U.S. sanctions must mean something. It's unnerving to see this administration not make that clear, unquote. I'm not sure if that's a threat, but no, the axis of resistance does not care about your sanctions. This latest development in Lebanon is surely remarkable for several reasons. The U.S. thought that by sanctioning Syria, it will get rid of Bashar al-Assad, and by sanctioning Lebanon, they will turn the people against Hezbollah. As the economic crisis worsened, Hezbollah imported fuel and medicine and helped people buy basic necessities at a low cost. This boosted their image and popularity as a result, to the point that even people who dislike Hezbollah don't really care that Hezbollah is bringing in the fuel. They just want relief from the economic crisis. So once the Americans, the Saudis, the French, and their friends realize that their plan of blaming all of Lebanon's woes and problems on Hezbollah and trying to turn public opinion against Hezbollah didn't work, once they realize that this is actually making Hezbollah look good, all of a sudden, after 13 months of political stalemate, you have the formation of a new government. Just like that. All of a sudden, after years of trying to get gas from Egypt and electricity from Jordan, the U.S. is okay with it. All of a sudden, after years of wars and sanctions against Syria, the U.S. is willing to break its own laws and sanctions to run this through Syria? Amazing, right? It turns out all that you need to do to get progress in Lebanon is for Hezbollah to suggest an idea and do it first, and then suddenly everyone else will want to do it as well. The U.S. is so desperate, it has backed itself into a political corner. Even in its own alternative plan with Egypt and Jordan, it has to involve Syria and break its own rules and violate its own sanctions to make it happen. Syria, by the way, has agreed to this, so in addition to providing trucks and letting the Iranian ships dock in Banias, Syria will help with this U.S. plan. So it's essentially a win-win for Lebanon. And although these fuel shipments aren't a long-term solution, they can't fix all of Lebanon's problems, nonetheless, they are a victory for the resistance front. It shows that U.S. hegemony and power in the Middle East is weakening. Iran, a country under U.S. sanctions, sent fuel to Syria, also a country under U.S. sanctions, which was then transported by Hezbollah's oil company, Al Amana, also under U.S. sanctions, to Lebanon, itself under a de facto U.S. siege. This is a historic shift in Middle Eastern geopolitics, and although they might not like it, what Hezbollah has done here is outmaneuver both its political rivals in Lebanon and internationally in a masterful game of chess. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the Limelight.
This summer's minimum ice cover was the 12th lowest ever, and scientists warn that the long-term trend towards shrinking continues. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tassin Thompson Ryder. This article is published under the heading Arctic Sea Ice Hits 2021 Minimum. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Arctic sea ice has passed its minimum extent for this year, shrinking to 4.72 million square kilometers on September 16th. The U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center, NSIDC, has reported. Owing to a cool and cloudy Arctic summer, this year's annual minimum was the highest since 2014. Ice covered nearly 1 million square kilometers, more than last year's extent of 3.82 million square kilometers, which was the second lowest ever observed. But it is still the 12th lowest sea ice extent in nearly 43 years of satellite recordings, and scientists say that